You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, what were the key ABA and NBA battles on and off the court? Before we continue the show, I want to tell you about a new HP Network podcast. You know that Nylon Calculus is the place to go for smart but accessible analysis of all things in the NBA. And now there's a new podcast called Nothing But Nylon. Hosted by Kevin Farragan, it is a place where NBA writers and researchers discuss their ideas and talk hoops and analytics. Check it out at nyloncalculus.com and on the Harvard Paroxysm Podcast Network. All right, welcome back to Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and welcome back, Rainus Lattice, to the program. Rainus, thank you so much for coming back.
It's great being on again, and it's great to have the opportunity to talk about the ABA, a truly exciting league. So I'm excited to talk about the league again.
So we're going to chat about the battles between the ABA and NBA, both on and off the court. We'll start with on the court, and talking about the history of some of the exhibition games and the super games that the ABA and NBA played together. Remember, the ABA has a fantastic article on this, which I'll link to in the show notes, which everyone should definitely check out. But the interleague games began in the summer of 71. It was a time in which it looked like there was going to be a merger between the two leagues. In fact, there was a plan to have one that would include all the ABA teams except for Virginia. So 10 teams added to the league. Teams agreed to preseason interleague games for the first time. The merger talks eventually fell apart, but they decided to keep playing the games anyway. It was also during the summer, there was also an ABA-NBA interleague all-star game, which the NBA won in a close game, 125-120. We'll get into the details about that in a little bit. Most of the early interleague games were played in ABA cities. The NBA teams didn't really want to legitimize the ABA teams by having them play at their homes, so the results were not publicized by that much for the NBA, because they didn't want to legitimize the ABA, and by the ABA because they pretty much in the first few games they went mostly the NBA's way. What do you think about as far as what it meant to the ABA at the time, as far as, you know, playing the interleague games, you know, do you feel like that was something that, even though the results didn't go necessarily well for the ABA, that was important to the league just to, you know, just to be on the map a little bit more by playing the NBA teams?
Well, looking back at it, yeah, I do think that it was an opportunity they really appreciated. The merger talks obviously didn't go through, but at least this gave them a chance to actually compete with NBA teams and sort of remind about their existence. So even if the NBA didn't, if particular franchise didn't really acknowledge the results and may, perhaps didn't talk about them, I think that it meant a lot for the players, because you could sense that they wanted to prove that they did fit in that same professional basketball landscape. And even if the victories didn't come as often as they would later on, the teams that became victorious in particular matchups, I think it gave them great pride that they could step on the same court as NBA players and prove to them that they are just as good or even better than their competitors.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the later years, the ABA pulled ahead and they won the overall rivalry 79-76, and only two games refused to schedule exhibition games with ABA teams, the Lakers and the Cavs. The Cavs are an interesting inclusion there. You know, Jack and Cook, I think Cook was fairly staunchly anti-ABA, but it's interesting that the Cavs were included in that. I don't know if there was... Maybe part of that is because there wasn't really an ABA city that close. Although, you know, Indianapolis is close enough, you would think there would be at least some interest there. But there were, you know, no games there. So that's sort of interesting that they were included in that.
Yeah, what boggles my mind is that there were owners like Red Auerbach. Well, not owners, but the people who ran organizations like Red Auerbach, who publicly dismissed the ABA and its players, but they would still play games from that very first summer on. And so, or I guess it mostly happened in autumn, but why the Cleveland Cavaliers didn't participate in any of these, I'm not certain about that as well. But most of the other teams, but despite the the conflicts they might have had, they pretty much faced ABA teams from the very first season that those games happened.
Yeah. And speaking of Celtics, Boston Globe sports writer Bob Ryan, he talked about, it's mentioned loose balls, but that, you know, when they began, the view in the ABA was, now we'll show these guys, but, you know, the ABA teams won nearly as often as the NBA did, and talked about the intensity of those games, and it was a surprise to him that the ABA did so well in those games eventually, and also talked about how, Billy Pultz, for instance, really took it to Dave Cowens and some of the individual matchups, you know, where he expected the NBA, you know, big men to dominate. That wasn't necessarily the case, despite the NBA having the reputation at having the, in reality, having most of the stronger big men, but still the ABA big men were able to bring it, even if they were less heralded.
And yeah, and as you go through these accounts, it's also a fun exercise to think about the validity of the opinion particular people had, because obviously the ones on the side of the NBA say that the games mattered more to the ABA franchises and that it was more so an exhibition for NBA teams, while others on the ABA side would point to like Larry Brown and Lewis Boyles. He would point out that, hey, Tommy Heinsohn was saying that the Celts aren't trying to win as much as we are, yet he would play his regulars 34 to 40 minutes. And obviously there are different accounts and different opinions, but all in all, it seems like the games were competitive enough because at the end of the day, the NBA also, I assume, didn't want to lose to a league they looked down upon, or at least some people looked down upon on it.
Yeah, although Bob Nedelicki, when he was on, he talked about how he didn't really think that there was necessarily that much extra intensity during those games. The players knew who could play, and there wasn't necessarily something extra to prove, and that generally the players, you know, all NBA or ABA players were, you know, it was more of a brotherhood. There wasn't necessarily the, they didn't feel pitted against each other. It was more obviously the management and on the coaching level where that was the intensity. So I thought that was sort of an interesting different perspective. For the most part, there were fairly tense environments, fairly intense feelings, but that wasn't necessarily universally thought of.
Yeah, that's funny enough. That's the one thing our podcast shared, that we both had Bob Nedelicki on, and I also wanted to say the same thing, and that's also an interesting thing to look at, because the reports and stories of the intensity of those games vary. There certainly is proof, like the multiple ejections and the technicals that were given out in these games. Yet, as you said, Bob Nedelicki himself said that NBA players respected ABA players, and that they basically were a fraternity, and that more so it was a fault of certain front office people. Well, although in a way I might be confusing intensity with animosity, but it definitely wasn't about the players hating each other. It was more so about the competitive spirit.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, and obviously different people feel different ways, but there's certainly, you know, there's enough evidence that some people felt something to prove. And then, you know, the Pacers, in I get the feeling that they may have had just more confidence in themselves because of how they dominated the ABA, and you know, that was a team that there may have been a different feeling among the Pacers than there may have been among some of the other NBA teams as well, just because the other ABA teams as well, just because of the success that they had and the stability that they had.
Yeah, and then there were people like Larry Brown, who obviously felt that he had something to prove. I suppose it was his payback for being too short to play in the NBA, or for them banning his buddy Doug Moe due to that alleged point-shaving scandal. But he of course, had to mention that fact. I'm talking about Larry Brown here, that they beat the Knicks before their championship year in 72 and 73. And in fact, I went through the scores, and Brown's Carolina Cougars had a record of 9-3 the 2 years he coached there. And oddly enough, none of their losses came against the Knicks, the Celtics, or the Bucks, against whom they were victorious. And then they wound up losing against the Hawks and the Suns. But yeah, different people, different agendas. So all in all, everybody had something to prove here, but the things they would take from those games and those results vary from their particular agendas.
So the so some of the games that stand out, obviously the first ABA-NBA All-Star game, which was May 28th, 1971 in Houston. There's a very good article about this from 22nd Timeout, the blog by David Friedman. We mentioned it in our in previous episode we did together. And Kareem actually was, he was supposed to play for the NBA side, but he was married the day before the game and his roster spot was not filled. Bill Russell coached the NBA 2 years after he had retired, and Larry Brown was the ABA coach. It was a close game, 105 to 100. They used NBA rules in the first half, so 24-second shot clock and no three-point shot, and then ABA rules in the second half, 30-second shot clock and three-point shot. I guess that gives the ABA a slight advantage because the strategy of the three-pointer at the time, for the most part, was you shot it if you were behind, you know, in the fourth quarter. A lot of coaches didn't like to use it beyond that. Some coaches did, but... so I guess that did, there was a slight advantage there for the ABA, although I guess the, you know, the NBA, they can use a three-pointer as, just as much, they're just not used to it. And the NBA led at halftime 66-64 after Elvin Hayes made a buzzer beater. And then the NBA had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter. Rick Barry and Charlie Scott, however, helped rally to them within a point, 47 seconds left, and then Oscar Robertson and Clyde Frazier sealed it with some free throws down the stretch. And while Frazier had a game-high 26 points and won a car as the game MVP, so I'm sure he needed another car, especially living in New York. But certainly a very competitive game. One interesting note here that I hadn't known about before reading is that the referees were from the NBA, and in the fourth quarter, the NBA All-Stars attempted 31 free throws, which would have been a single game regular season record at the time. So they got a lot more free throws, even though they went 6 from 23 from the field, and the ABA went 10 from 20 during the field in the fourth quarter. So it's sort of interesting, you know, maybe just the, you know, the Oscar Robertson, Earl Monroe, John Havlicek getting, you know, all were players who could draw free throws. So maybe it was legitimate, or maybe there was some bias, conscious or unconscious, during that situation. But I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, an article for the Houston Chronicle by Michael Murphy. I'm pretty certain I found this at rememberTheABA.com, and even if I didn't, it's any moment is a good moment for a shout out for that page. But yeah, the article contained the claims by Mel Daniels that they were NBA refs and the calls started going against them, and that they played well, but the situation with the refs kind of ruined the game. And yeah, it's sad to hear that, and there is seemingly some credence to his words, but you know, there might be some revisionist history to that, because Mel also was quoted as saying that they had them down big, and from what I can tell, that it was a back and forth game. So yeah, who knows? Probably there's a bit of truth to both sides.
This one I don't believe we have footage of, so no one's going to be able to prove anything here. But the fact that it was such a close competition is certainly speaks well. I mean, I think probably the expectations heading into it from a lot of people were that the NBA would wipe the floor with them, but obviously the ABA certainly put a good competition, and from what we know of the time, I mean, the NBA was. In 71, the NBA was probably still clearly the stronger league, but the top-end talent for the ABA was just as good as the top-end talent for the NBA, so that certainly fits in with that.
Yeah, and I think it's still like a year or two before the ABA started stealing away the really big stars like the Julius Irvings and the George McGinnis's. So in a way, you don't expect ABA to win this first matchup.
Yeah. The first actual exhibition game, September 21st, 71, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Dallas Chaparrals. Kareem does play in this game. He has 32 points in the game, and McCoy McLemore for the Bucks hits a game-winning jumper with 11 seconds left in the game to cap it off. But the Dallas, not a particularly good franchise during this time, so it's interesting that ended up being the team that was chosen. The Bucks, of course, were coming off of a championship in 71 and were an extremely good team. So A couple other games that stand out to me are one, a Sonics 117-93 win over the Pacers. This is actually the only interleague game that was booked in an NBA arena in 71. And oddly, the Pacers did not do well in the early exhibitions from 71 to 73, in which they, you know, they won two championships and were a very good team the other season. They went 2-13 and were actually 7-15 overall in these exhibition games, which I guess maybe the Pacers just did not have a lot of intensity going into this game. Maybe that's what Neto was talking about, the fact that you know, maybe they didn't really care so much about it. And they lost a lot of games to the Pistons of all teams as well, who were not really a great team for the most part during that time. So I found that interesting.
Yeah, and perhaps they just play the games at the wrong time, because even though 71-72, that's still a very good Indiana team. The NBA ABA interleague games coincide with the downslide of Roger Brown, and if Indiana had played against particular NBA teams like 2 or 3 years ago, when probably they also would have more to prove, as you already alluded to, maybe they would have had an easier time back then. But all in all, yeah, that's still a very good Indiana Pacers team, and If the games matter, they probably should have had a better record and would have achieved that.
It also, the Pacers, you know, by 72 and 73, their regular season performance, you know, their SRS is not particularly high, and their, you know, the win totals are, you know, in the low mid 50s. So they're not necessarily playing at an elite level in the regular season, but they would step it up during the playoffs. So I wonder, in the exhibition, there would be less incentive to try, certainly, than even in the regular season. So maybe it's just a case of them, you know, turning it on when it mattered, as a veteran team that's already, you know, won championships and doesn't have really that much to prove.
Yeah, and they're playing 82-84 game seasons, and most of their star players would play like 40 or 38 minutes for Slick Leonard. So yeah, you can't even blame them that some games in the September wouldn't matter as much for them. It probably was more so an exhibition game for them than for certain other teams in the ABA.
Yeah. And then the most notable game from 71 would be the two champions, the Milwaukee Bucks and the Utah Stars, 122-114, a Bucks win. And it was a sellout crowd, dubbed the Super Bowl of basketball in Salt Lake City. The Bucks were only ahead by one with 5 minutes left, but were able to pull away during the stretch. Kareem had 36 points, Willie Wise had 33, Zelma Beatty had 29 points, and Oscar Robertson had 24 points. So a competitive game, I'm sure a fun matchup between Kareem, who was transcendent, and Zelma Beatty, who had an awesome season, you know, one of the best seasons of the 70s, honestly, even though obviously for his career he was very good, but not in Kareem's class as a player. But that certainly would have been an interesting matchup. Beatty was somebody who Will Chamberlain talked about as being, you know, one of his tough defenders. So even though he would have been undersized against Kareem in terms of height, he would have been bigger and more powerful than Kareem. So seeing that matchup, I think would have been fun.
Yeah, he's the one who from all the reports you get to read, he's the one who probably had all the tricks in the book with which he could bother a rather young Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at that point. So he probably would have a shot at least at slowing him down and competing. And as for the Super Bowl of basketball, the first connection I have is that I wonder whether Will Ferrell knew about this and whether it inspired the Mega Bowl in the movie Semi-Pro.
It wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, it's so many ABA allusions in that movie. The second Super Game, which is May 25th, 1972, exactly 7 years before I was born, by the way, was in Nassau Coliseum, and the NBA actually threatened to fine or suspend any player who participated in the game, but that didn't stop the players from assembling another team, including six top 50 players. Elgin Baylor was the coach for the NBA. Wilt Chamberlain was the team captain. Al Bianchi and Mel Daniels were the ABA equivalents of that. So this game is on YouTube, and the first three quarters of it, unfortunately, the fourth quarter of it is not on YouTube. As we talked about that a bit in our previous show. What stands out to you as far as, you know, kind of your observations of the game?
Yeah, There are a few things. First off, I'm blanking on the name. What was Donnie Freeman takes a charge in first quarter on Archie Clark. So that definitely tells you something about All-Star games back then. You wouldn't see anyone taking a charge in 2016 in the All-Star game. And what I found interesting was that the ABA actually was quite dominant in the first half, and they had a lead of 49-30 after some quality play from Julius Erving, Ralph Simpson, and George Thompson. I believe those were the three main guys who sparked that run. But the NBA kind of cut the lead down before the half. It was down to six. And the recording of the game we have has three or four player interviews, one with Wilt, one with Julius. And the most interesting one was with Oscar Robertson, who was quite confident at the half. And he was claiming that the coach, Elgin Baylor, is giving everyone playing time. And in the second half, the NBA will go with guys that know how to win such games. And yeah, that the ABA guys can play, but that he was pretty confident about them being the victors in the second half, as it turned out to be.
And this is, I think this would be the only, unless they played some time during the exhibition, I didn't check that, but this would only be the only game with Julius Erving and Connie Hawkins on opposite teams, at least, you know, of professional game, even though it's an exhibition one.
Yeah, it must have been the battle of the two claws, the guys with the extremely the big hands back then.
Yes.
And Julius actually, the disappearance of him actually ends up being, not disappearance, but the lack of his playing time actually ends up being the big thing about this game. As Hotshot Hundley actually talks about it during the broadcast, he doesn't seem to be one of his coaches, Al Bianchi's top five guys. So he doesn't play almost any minutes in the third quarter, during which the NBA turned it into a back and forth game. And we don't know actually what happened in the fourth quarter, as there's no recording of it. But it does seem like the ABA was playing the best with Julius on the court, and they sort of let that lead slip when he was on the bench. And what's most amazing is that Al Bianchi was his coach at Virginia, so you would think that he would actually play Julius more than he would play the other guys. So that sort of seems confusing to me.
Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised as well. Yeah, 22nd timeout does have an account of the fourth quarter, even though the footage is missing. But at the end of the game, Rick Barry hits a three-pointer with 13 seconds left to cut the NBA's lead to one. And then Archie Clark gets fouled. He makes his first shot, misses the second one. There's a wild scramble for the rebound, and then Barry emerges with the ball. He tries a desperation three-pointer, and it falls short, and then the NBA wins 106 to 104. Bob Lanier, he was selected game MVP with 15 points. So it came down to dramatic fashion. That sounds like that would be a wonderful thing to see. And you mentioned the previous show, but there's an incredible dunk from Julius Erving in this game as well. That is, you know, one of the ones that is brought up as far as the, you know, fantastic ones. It was a similar to his famous free throw line dunk that he had in the famously in the 76 dunk contest.
Yeah, and the fact that he pulled off with in a real game situation with Oscar Robertson right nearby, or at least somewhere involved in the play, it makes it even more miraculous. And it's almost like somebody's, I don't know, it's the fact that this game exists for the first three quarters, and there's none footage of the fourth quarter. It's somebody's playing a trick on us. I don't know.
Yes, yes.
And actually there, Julius does appear to dunk in the second quarter, or at least it seems so, judging from the reactions of Don Criqui and Hot Rod Hundley. But this game does have some temporary problems in regards to the video track. And the one time he does something as spectacular as that during the first three quarters, it's also invisible to us. There are a couple of layups there, but the two dunks he made are the ones which we can't see.
You're right. Somebody's playing a trick on us, unfortunately. 1972, there is a Hawks Colonels 112-99 game. It's one of the two games that Irving played for the Hawks. He had 20 points and 18 rebounds in 42 minutes. And the NBA fines the Hawks $25,000 because the Bucks had drafted Irving. So this leads to a situation where Irving ends up going back to the ABA and playing for the Squares for a second season. In 73, there is a Nets-Knicks exhibition game where the Nets win 97-87. The Knicks had been NBA champions in the 73 season, so the Nets beat them soon after acquiring Julius Irving. It's at Madison Square Garden. Irving has 27 points, and Frazier has 25 points for the Knicks. In 74, there is a Nets Bullets overtime game. The Nets win 101-98. It's in Washington, D.C. And the interesting thing about this is that five Nets players, including Irving, have to wear Bullets road uniforms because there's a luggage mix-up. So that one, that one's fun for that. I guess it's nice that the Bullets and Nets uniforms would have been fairly close to each other, at least in terms of the colors, so they could somehow make that work. But I found that interesting. It reminds me of some of the other ABA stories about, like, you know, uniforms being missing, or, you know, where they have to turn, you know, a home uniform inside out to play in the game or things like that. You know, that's a fun one.
Yeah, I hope I'm not blasting Earl Foreman here. Well, it's not the actual truth, but I do think I remember something about his teams not having any money towards the latter parts of the ABA, and then he would borrow money for cleaning uniforms or something along those lines. I think there was definitely something similar to that.
You're right. Yeah, it's a I believe that, you know, the sheriffs or police, you know, show up and are wanting to basically repossess the uniforms because of the cleaning bill. And then I forget who it might have been, Dick Tinkham, or somebody who is quoted often in the book, who is a, you know, executive for one of the teams, basically is like, you know, yeah, you know, you're not really going to, you know, you're not going to stop us from playing this game. We're just going to give them the road uniforms. So you might as well, you know, you kind of smooth things over. And eventually he was able to pay the bill. But yes, it's one of those. Only in the 70s, only in the ABA type story. In 74, there's the first game in Market Square Arena between the Pacers and the Bucks. The Pacers win 118-115. It's an ABA record crowd of 17,287. Bob Dandridge has 46 points in the game. Kareem has 26 points. George McGinnis has 24 points. You actually talked to Bob Nadalickly a little bit about this game in your podcast with him. Is there anything that stands out to you that, you know, beyond what I just said?
Well, all of the accounts just have glowing reports from Pacers fans. It really is a for an exhibition game. It really goes down in Pacers history as a monumental game, and it speaks to the probably the event of opening up a new arena was important, but it speaks to the fact how big the showdown was between the Bucks and the Pacers. And mind you, the Pacers are sort of towards the tail end of their fairy tale. It's the last season of George McGinnis, and he didn't have a that good of a supporting cast. So then pulling out this victory is something that goes down in Pacers history as a fine moment. So yeah, I definitely wanted to touch on this game. It is one of the most I don't know, famous ABA NBA contests.
In 75, there's a few that are interesting. The last season where they would have done exhibitions before the merger, the Stars beat the Sonics 122-119, and the two teams combined, and I can hardly believe this, for 119 shots from the free throw line during the game. Leonard Gray for the Sonics is ejected for punching Steve Green of the Stars. Ron Boone has 23 points, which I can't even imagine how what the story behind that was. I couldn't find anything more about it beyond that, but that's definitely, I'm glad that one doesn't have any video footage, quite frankly, because I think that would set basketball back quite a bit if we were able to see that. 75 also has the matchup between the previous NBA and ABA champions, the Colonels and the Warriors. The Colonels win 93-90. Actually, surprisingly low attendance. Only drew 88,000 in Louisville. Marv Roberts had 20 points for the Colonels. Artis Gilmore, 14 points, 11 rebounds. Rick Barry has an off game, 9 points of 3 from 11 for the field, and a 3-point air ball with 31 seconds left in the game. So the fact that the Warriors kept it so close despite Barry playing so poorly, they've made it pretty competitive. The Colonels obviously able to pull that off. Issel must have been traded at this point, because this would have been during the offseason when he was traded first at the Claws and then ended up at the Nuggets. So the Colonels would not have been at full strength, but still, interesting game nonetheless.
Yeah, and this is really the year where, first off, the amount of games seems the biggest between from all of the NBA, ABA contest off seasons, and this is also the year where you can notice a real advantage towards the ABA, and they really shredded the NBA apart, both the average teams and the good teams. There, I'm not sure of the record, but they were quite dominant this off, and which would ultimately be the last off season.
Yeah, you're right, and which is interesting because several of the ABA teams, of course, are about to fold, and they're very weak on the court. As we mentioned, the ABA was kind of top heavy at this point, and the premier franchises were very good, and the bad franchises had very little talent. So the fact that even the lesser teams seem to do pretty well is interesting. Speaking of lesser teams, the Baltimore Claws, they had one of three games they ever played in their history. They lost to the Sixers 103-82. Doug Collins had 28 points for the Sixers. I'm not sure if Dan Issel actually played in this game or not, but I know he – I'm not sure he ever – he was on the Claws franchise, but I'm not sure he ever actually played a game for the Claws. I can't remember if he ever mentioned that, and if that was ever mentioned in Loose Balls or any of the other articles I read in the Claws, but –
I'm actually sad about the fact that they could have played at least one game as the Baltimore Hustlers, and it never happened. That this would have been the time to do it.
Yes, yes, that would have been glorious. Yes. The 75, it sounds like a very fun game between the Warriors and the Nets. Warriors won 119-114, and Rick Barry had 49 points and Julius Erving had 43 points. I can only imagine the duel that those two had, but that sounds, of any of these games, that may have been the one that I would like to see the most.
Yeah, probably. They are, well, Barry had torn his knee up beforehand, but two superstar small forwards, probably the best in each of their in their positions in their particular league, and just facing up in their primes, it would have been awesome. And I just love the fact that Barry was on both sides of these contests. He obviously switched leagues twice, but no matter which side he's on, he's just getting technicals and ejections in all of those games. So
yes.
It did, the ABA NBA rivalry didn't matter to Barry. He would have found a reason to be angry at each of these games.
Yes, yeah, he had no problem being angry whoever was in front of him, that's for sure. And then the last game of interest, it may have been the last exhibition game period. The Sixers 131, the Pacers 129 in two overtimes, and this is George McGinnis, the first time he'd faced the Pacers as a 76ers player. 27 points in that game. Billy Knight had 29 points. Steve Mix for the Sixers had 24 points. Fred Carter for the Sixers had 22 points, and Dan Roundwood for the Pacers had 21 points. So sounds like an exciting game as well.
And I think there is a story of McGinnis returning to Indiana and receiving a standing ovation. The crowd wasn't – they understood the situation. They knew that the Pacers team was on the downfall and that McGinnis would earn more money in the NBA. So they weren't even mad at him for returning in a other uniform, and they received him quite well.
Well, that's nice to hear, obviously. Obviously he spoke highly of his years in Indiana afterward. Didn't really necessarily want to leave Indiana. It was just sort of a situation where at that point, the Pacers had no money to pay him, and he was, just looking for a better situation for him, which he got in Philly. So looking at the theoretical finals matchups, if we took the team that won the NBA championship and the ABA championship for each years that the two leagues were in existence, going head to head, we just wanted to touch on a little bit, who might win a theoretical matchup between these teams. And The first year, the Pittsburgh Pipers, led by Connie Hawkins, and the Boston Celtics, of course, with Bill Russell, John Havlicek, Sam Jones. This is 1968. This is the second to last year for Russell dynasty. So the Celtics are still a strong team, but are aging. The Pipers, have some good players, but other than Hawkins, are not particularly a deep team. I would say that the key for this series would be the Celtics defense being able to counter the individual brilliance of Hawkins, and also the fact that, you know, the big men for the Pipers really not being able to, even though Russell's certainly not a big scoring threat during this time, the Pipers did not have any kind of big man who would even compare to Russell during this time. So I would say that the Celtics would almost certainly be the likely winner of this series.
Yeah, the first year of the ABA just was too chaotic for me to even consider the Pipers here against the Celtics dynasty. 21 players stepped on the court for the Pipers that year, which reminds you of this year's Memphis Grizzlies. And
yeah,
guys like Art Heyman and Chico Juan averaged 20 points per game, huge improvements for them when compared to their previous years in the NBA. So I think those first two, 3 years have the most cases of ABA stats being fluky. And I think that, yeah, the Celtics would run their mean green machine, and the Pipers players would get lost in it. They would, I think they would pick on their weaknesses and just outrun them with their traditional fast court basketball of Russell defending the rim and then just outletting towards whoever can run the break.
Yeah, the one wrench that I would put in this is if the Pipers, if there was a 3-point line, whether it was for the whole series or for the home games or what have you, I do think that the Pipers were keyed a lot by the 3-pointer, and that would add an interesting wrench to the proceedings. I mean, Vaughn and Charlie Williams both were, you know, very good 3-point shooters, both percentage and volume for the time. So I do think that is the only kind of thing where I would say, well, maybe there's a shot at least they could take a game or two. But yes, overall, definitely, it would have to be Boston series.
There would have been a game three, which the Pipers won thanks to a barrage of 3-pointers and make it 1-2, and the Red chokes on a cigar and
right.
Without all these youngins shooting these threes, what the hell are they doing?
Yes.
But yeah, it would end in 4-1 Celtics.
Yes, so the 69 one is really interesting to me. The Oakland Oaks, who have Rick Barry, Doug Moe, Larry Brown, and Warren Jabali against the Boston Celtics, who, of course, you know, have a similar squad to the 69 team, but are a year older. Russell and Sam Jones sort of slowing down during this time. Havlicek really, stepping up during this season, and he's already a great player, but even greater. They were in terms of record, they were a weaker team, but they actually had a stronger SRS that season, a 5.35. The Oaks have one of the best SRSs in ABA history with a 7.6 SRS. And while certainly, you know, as you mentioned, the ABA years early are fairly weak, I do think there is enough. You know, Jim Eakins is on this team as well, and he's a fairly he would be a strong big man in the ABA, and certainly they are at a disadvantage at that position. But I do think, you know, Doug Moe as a wing defender, you know, whether he's taking a Havlicek or Bailey Howell, you know, whether the Celtics have someone who can effectively defend Rick Barry. You know, whether Larry Brown is big enough to compete with the Celtics guards, I would, especially, we do have to very much consider whether, you know, because Barry was not healthy for the actual ABA finals, but if we're putting both teams at full strength, I do think the Oaks might have a shot at being the Celtics here, especially if Barry is healthy. Without, I would definitely pick the Celtics, but it's definitely an interesting choice. And how the Celtics are able to defend someone like Jabali as well, who is just all these, you know, this incredible rebounding for size and this incredible toughness, and, you know, whether Havlicek could have handled him or how that all shakes out, I think that's really interesting. A lot of interesting theoreticals in that series.
Yeah, the question for me is, do the Oaks have a healthy Rick Barry? Because if that's a scenario we're playing here, I'm crazy enough to say that I'm leaning with the Hawks here, because this Celtics team was in its last fumes. Russell and Sam Jones would retire after a year, and in a way, it's a miracle that they get past that Lakers team in that legendary finals series. Obviously, the strength of teams in the first years of the ABA has to be taken into account, but when you look at being first in both offensive and defensive ratings, that's something unheard of. So I think I actually would have the Hawks over the Celts without Barry. I do believe that age is a factor here, and that the collective power of Jabali, Mo, and Barry, it would be too much for the Celtics perimeter players. So yeah, I'm going with the Hawks, as mad as that might sound, because given the fact how great the Celtics franchise was back then.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I would say is I do think this Hawks team is better than the Warriors team that Barry took to the finals a couple seasons before in the NBA. Certainly these Celtics are not as good as the 76ers, and the Warriors, you know, they took that 76ers team to six games and had a pretty competitive series. So I think, you know, given what we know about Barry against NBA competition, I feel like I'm willing to go ahead and go with that. You know, I think we're on some decent ground here to say that the Hawks would win with Barry. So we'll go ahead and make that the official prediction. In 1970, the Pacers against the Knicks, a lot of similarities between these teams, really. I mean, you know, you think of Freddie Lewis and Clyde Frazier, Mel Daniels and Willis Reed, Roger Brown. I think he would be probably the best individual player here in 1970. Maybe you could make that argument for Frazier, or maybe even for, I don't know, Reed and Daniels, I think, are a pretty good kind of canceling each other out. But, you know, obviously the Knicks have DeBuscher as, you know, a rugged defender. They probably have a stronger bench, although the Pacers, they have a really good, you know, they have their other key players, Ned Olicky, Billy Keller. You know, they're probably not quite as deep as they would be later on in the 70s, and they were definitely the weaker regular season team. They only had a 2.67 SRS. The Knicks have an 8.42 SRS, one of the best in the league during that time. And you know, they have Dick Barnett. They have they've Cassie Russell coming off the bench. So I would probably have to go with the Knicks here, but I do wonder, because I'm not, you know, DeBuscher is kind of their stout defensive player, but I think he's probably going to be a little bit too slow to defend Roger Brown.
Yeah, and the thing is that given what I've heard, seen, and read about Roger Brown, there literally was no stopping him. He put together some amazing playoff games at this point. So I sort of looked at it this by taking the safe way out and saying that when two great teams meet each other at least twice, you know, the 73 Knicks and 73 Pacers also have a hypothetical matchup, that such teams usually split their finals matchups. So I would believe more so in the 1970 Pacers if either of those Pacers teams would be capable of beating the Knicks. And I'd bet on Roger Brown in his prime being able to score despite whatever the Knicks can put up against him, in this case being Dave DeBuscher.
Yeah. One thing that Frazier would have that size advantage over Lewis, because Lewis was about 6 foot, so that would be big. Also, Reed's outside shooting might give him an advantage over Daniels, although I think Daniels would probably be a bit of a better rebounder. So, yeah, I think it's kind of a too close to call situation. I kind of agree with you on both the 70 and 73 situations are very close to call. And those teams both evolved in similar ways too, which we'll get to a little bit in 73. But I'm willing to go with that. The 71 is the Milwaukee Bucks and the Utah Stars. I think the biggest advantage here is just Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just being fantastic. And even though the Stars have Zelmo Beatty, and he was extremely good that season, I believe in Kareem here. And the Bucks were one of the most dominant teams in basketball history in the regular season. 11.91 SRS, which I think is the record. So the Stars, you know, very good in their league and very competitive. And, you know, they had some real good depth with with Willie Wise and those guys. But, you know, the Bucks obviously have Oscar Robertson. I think they have the advantage at guard. I think they pretty much have the advantage at the key positions, although I do think probably overall the Stars have more good players. You know, they have that Ron Boone's emerging. They have Merv Jackson, Red Robbins, and Glenn Combs. You know, I mean, the Bucks of Dandridge and stuff too. So, I mean, both teams are fairly deep. This is the deepest of the Bucks teams that they would kind of be hurting for depth a little bit later as Robertson got older. But they Bob Boozer as well. So I would say the Bucks are probably a pretty handy winner here. But I think the Stars would give them a tough fight.
Yeah, it's tough for me to make these decisions based on the greatness of NBA players when I admittedly love the ABA and do think that some of their stars are underrated. But would Zelmo Beatty really be capable of slowing down Kareem in this series? I think that's the biggest question. And as much old man tricks as he had, the answer is probably a no. And then there's, of course, Oscar, and I don't know who the Utah Stars put up against him. I guess it would be Willie Wise. Then that's also a so-so matchup, although Wise at least has a youth advantage here. But yeah, it comes down to the fact that it's tough to take the Stars over a dominant Abdul-Jabbar with the help of Dandridge, Robertson, and McLaughlin, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. 1972, the Pacers and the Lakers. Lakers, one of the great dominant teams of all time, of course, 69 wins and 33 games in a row. And I certainly believe in the Pacers being a tough, crafty team. And they had even more depth this year with McGinnis had come in. Rick Mount was, even though his time in Pacers wasn't really very happy for him, he was scoring pretty well. Darnell Hillman is there. But the Pacers did not achieve in the regular season, even though the roster looks stacked. They were only 47 wins and a 2.72 SRS compared to the 69 wins for the Lakers, 11.65 SRS. And, you know, but at this point, I think the leagues were pretty close to equal, but just the Lakers' dominance over their league compared to the Pacers' dominance over their league. I don't think the Pacers have an answer for Wilt at all. So I would have to go with the Lakers in this series. I'd give some respect to the Pacers, but I just think the Lakers are going to be too much here.
Yeah, and it speaks to something you alluded to previously, that the Pacers just didn't have the best regular seasons, and it seems like they would pull it together for the playoffs, and they were capable of beating teams with their collective cohesiveness and the chemistry they had. But yeah, it's just tough to take this Pacers team, which won 47 games against an all-time Lakers team with two top 15 guys of all time in Chamberlain and Jerry West, and just a team with a 33 game winning streak. And yeah, it seems unfair that we're praising the NBA teams against whom the Pacers are going up against here, the Knicks and the Lakers. But man, those really are some teams for the ages. So they would have a tough matchup against them.
Yeah. 73 is the Pacers and Knicks again. I do think the McGinnis and DeBuscher matchup would be really fascinating. With DeBuscher's getting older here, but he still has that, you know, that rugged toughness, and McGinnis is such a physical player, and to see them kind of, you know, play as well as how, you know, kind of Monroe fits into things, you know, how he would match up with Freddie Lewis and Jerry Lucas's outside shooting, what element that would bring. I do think that, you know, in the this is kind of a good, even though the Pacers' older players are aging, you know, McGinnis is kind of emerging into his prime. They're both very deep teams. I mean, the Knicks have six Hall of Famers, you know, plus two Hall of Fame coaches on their roster, and the Pacers are a who's who of the greatest players in ABA history. So, like I said, I think I can concur that, you know, most like a situation would be the Knicks winning one series and the Pacers winning the other series.
Yeah, and David DeBuscher is almost like a typical forward from the late 60s, early 70s. Well, George McGinnis would be a specimen even today. So that's the one key that they don't have 3 years ago, that George McGinnis is young. He's 22, and he probably would demolish his matchup individually. But on the other hand, Roger Brown is no more the Roger Brown. Everybody knows he averaged only 12.6 points per game in the playoffs. That's pretty low for him. So I do believe that, oh no, the 70s team has a better shot at it, despite the addition of McGuinness. And I think they would be beaten handily in 73. They are just too old for me.
The 74 team matchup is the Celtics with a 3.42 SRS, having Dave Cowens, John Havlicek, of course, JoJo White, Paul Silas, and the Nets with Julius Erving, Larry Keenan, Billy Pultz, Brian Taylor. The Nets, a very young team. The Celtics are, Havlicek and Silas are older. Cowens and JoJo White are more in their prime. So this is a tough one. I don't know if anyone on the Celtics is really equipped to stop Irving, but I do think that the depth and experience for the Celtics obviously is certainly an advantage.
Yeah, and in my opinion, the Celtics core is a bit better, so a lot of it would depend on Julius and whether he could be the best player in the series, since it should be somewhat close. And you know, for a lot of times, Julius showed that he could do that, but the Celtics might be a bit too steep of a hill for him to climb alone. So I'm leaning more so Boston's way because of their collective talent. But on the other hand, this team with Larry Keane and Billy Pultz and Wendell Ladner, I think it's deep enough for the Nets to have a decent shot. We'll get 76, but they don't have that amount of depth this time around. So I think it would the Nets would have a decent shot. And for what it's worth, the Celtics beat the Nets before the 73-74 season by 19, thanks to 37 points by Havlicek. So that shows what I know. But I think they could compete. But yeah, overall, I think the Celtics are better.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's fairly close to a toss-up, but it would depend on how well the Celtics could contain Irving, or just contain the options around him, and make him not necessarily be as complete of a player. So, but that would be a fun one. One of the series I would enjoy the most.
And also a lot of it depends on Billy Pultz and Larry Keenan, two rather young guys going up against the veterans and Dave Cowens and Paul Silas, who certainly know every trick in the book, and they would have to step up and be ready to compete against those two guys. It certainly would be a battle on the boards. They would have to at least be competitive in order for the Nets to have a chance.
Absolutely. So 75, the Golden State Warriors with a 2.86 SRS, the Kentucky Colonels 6.24. I think the biggest keys here are just Artis Gilmore. The Warriors do not really have a great option for defending him. But then again, the Colonels had been upset a few seasons before by the Rick Barry-led Nets. So I do think Rick Barry had proven himself to be a problem against the Colonels, and that would be a tough situation for them. Both the Warriors and Colonels are interesting because both of those teams were famous for going 10 deep. So they like to use a lot of players and share a lot of the load. And, I can't, really say particularly, whether there's a particularly strong advantage anywhere else. I mean, Jamal Wilkes, obviously, he was a rookie and emerging for the Warriors, a key piece for the team, but not necessarily a star yet, where, Issel may have been a little bit of trouble for the Warriors to contain. Dampier, aging at this point, still effective, but not, quite the player that he had been. But, whether, like a Butch Beard can contain him, a lot of interesting matchups. I do think that the Colonels, just based on their regular season success, I would definitely place them as a favorite. And it would be hard for them to stop Gilmore, but there's enough uncertainty there where I would at least, would think about it.
Yeah, I basically agree. I think the advantage up front would decide the series. I just can't see how the Warriors could handle Artis Gilmore and Dan Issel, with all due respect to Clifford Ray and George Johnson, and Jamal Wilkes probably would have been involved in those matchups as well. But despite Rick Barry probably averaging close to 40 or something, I have the Colonels being as the better team. But as you said, they had plenty of mishaps in the playoffs, and this Warriors team in particular was known for playing against the odds and beating the superior team. So there is a this sort of feel to the series that anything could happen. But I believe the Cardinals being the best team, so I would go with them. And what's interesting is that remember the ABA had a footnote that after this regular season, the Cardinals actually challenged the Golden State Warriors to a World Series of basketball with the winner stake of $1 million purse, but the Warriors reportedly refused the challenge, although they did wound up playing next fall with the Cardinals winning by three. That's the game where you mentioned where Barry shot a three-point air ball with 31 seconds left in the game. So I don't know whether they decided to play either way or something did actually happen in regards to the TV revenues generated during that game, but there was an actual matchup between the two of them.
It's kind of neat that they did play. I mean, one of the two, I believe it's two instances of the champions playing each other, you know, in the season afterwards. So the last one, the 1976, would be the Boston Celtics, 2.25 SRS, and the Nets with a 2.56 SRS. As in 74, I think the key differences are the better depth for the Celtics, but with Irving's individual brilliance, the Nets are a more experienced but not quite as talented team. The Celtics are aging at this point. Havlicek is 35, and so you know you're getting to a point. You know, JoJo White's 29. Very good team, but it would be tough. I think that Irving being even further into his prime and even further into his brilliance and the way that he played in 76, I would probably give it to the Nets in this situation, but it is very close. And I do think the Celtics still have the overall team, but I feel like I can count on Irving here even more than in 74 to be able to kind of pull it through.
Yeah, what scares me about is the depth you talked about. And the Celtics have a notable addition in Charlie Scott, with whom Irving played. Yeah, and but as you said, the Celtics core is getting older. And if it goes down to a game six or game seven, I can, or game seven probably, I can imagine Irving having one of those 40-point and 20-rebound games. And there doesn't seem to be a thing that Celtics could do about it. I don't know who would be checking him. It'd probably be Havlicek, but you know, he's sort of a player from a different generation and is an example of how in the NBA sort of had these veteran forwards in their 30s who just played a different game in comparison to the Irvings and Gervins and David Thompsons, who soon joined the league from the ABA. So it would have been interesting matchup-wise. What would have the Celtics done as a rather old team against the high-flying Julius Irving? And then John Williamson, obviously himself, who was no slouch. Maybe he was more of a grounded player, but it would have been tough physically defending him as well.
Yeah, and you might have gotten a sense of what the Blazers did in 77 with Bob Gross, who's kind of that sort of similar style small forward where, you know, their tactic was to make Irving run as much as possible and, you know, play really hard on defense to kind of tire him out a little bit on offense. And even though Irving was very effective in those finals, but it still, you know, was a strategy that did help the Blazers win that series. So you may have seen, if they had certainly thought of that, you may have seen the Celtics try that. I mean, they obviously, I don't know if Irving would have definitely necessarily been defending Havlicek, but if he had been, Havlicek was, you know, famed despite his age for his tirelessness, and maybe just, you know, running him, trying to run Irving off the court may have been, you know, the best strategy they had.
And that series is also similar from a point of view, and I'm scared of this topic, so I'll sort of just allude to it, and that's it. But there is also some certain racial undertones that the Blazers were, similarly to the Celtics, a white team. From most of their players were from NBA experience and supposedly play the right way. And here are the 76ers led by Julius Irving and George McGinnis, who could attempt all these flashy things and, you know, sort of played what people considered to be street ball.
Yes. Well, and ironically, of course, the 77 season, once Irving's in the NBA, the Sixers beat the Celtics in a seven-game series in the 77. You know, a similar Celtics team versus, you know, obviously a team dominated by Irving. And then, you know, in that case, the more streetball team, you know, won the series against the vaunted Celtics. So even though, you know, the in the finals it worked out differently because obviously the Blazers had more talent and balance. But Irving was the one who finally dethroned the Celtics from the top of the NBA, which, you know, some interesting irony there.
Yeah.
So Renis, is there anything else you'd like to talk about as far as the ABA-NBA matchups?
Yeah, well, one small thing is that we talked about all of these champions going up against each other, and ultimately certain ABA teams did go deep in the NBA playoffs and have their success. If you look at the 78 Nuggets, they had a rotation full of ABA guys, from David Thompson, Dan Issel, Bobby Jones to role players like Darnell Hillman, and the 79 Spurs, did the same with Gervin, Larry Keane, and James Silas. Their top eight guys in minutes all were ABA originals. So even if they didn't win a title, the ABA certainly proved it after the merger that teams full of ABA players could compete and participate at the highest level and reach the conference finals.
Yeah, and I'm having another episode with Adam Johnson where we're going to talk a lot about how the ABA teams themselves did in the NBA and some of the key players, how they did. And of course, famously, half of the starting lineups of the 77 finals were former ABA players, and many of the All-Stars, I think 10 of the 24 All-Stars were from the ABA. So obviously at that point, the ABA demonstrated, how much it belonged in the league and how much they had accomplished and represented themselves very well in the league. So thank you so much, Reynis, for being on the show. Do you want to tell everyone a little bit about your podcast and YouTube channel?
Yeah, I stumbled through all of the things I do last time around. So this time I'll just keep it short, listeners of your show can find the Handle podcast on iTunes or on lamarmatic.com. And on the podcast, I interview former ABA and NBA players. At this point, James Donaldson was my last guest and a one-time All-Star with the 80s Mavericks. So be sure to check out some conversations I've had with former players about their careers and just their lives in general.
It's a great podcast. I really enjoy listening to it and appreciate bringing your perspective and getting some great guests. Some people I haven't heard from or knew very little about. So I learn a lot every time I listen to it and appreciate that. And also your Lamarmatic YouTube page that has some great footage of pro basketball from the past. Some really great finds that you have and really appreciate all that you do to help you keep the history of the game alive.
Yeah, it's only likewise, Jason. I enjoy this Basketball Mysteries of the 70s series a lot, and I'm also plowing through the older episodes. I'm somewhere in the middle of 2015, so I'm also going through those. And it's an honor that there are so many great podcasts dedicated to basketball history out there, and that we can collaborate on something like this.
I appreciate that. Thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at harvardprofessism.com, and we're on iTunes and Stitcher. And any other place you want to listen to podcasts, we're probably there, too. So just if you could leave us a rating and review if you like what you're hearing. Hopefully you're enjoying the series. We're going to be here for the rest of the offseason doing episodes on basketball mysteries of the 1970s. So until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.